Tom, you start your book by talking about this ancient Greek guy, Diogenes, who said this outrageous thing that, well, tell me what he said about dead bodies more than 2,000 years ago.
Well, what his students and friends ask him, what should we do with your body when you die, master? And he said, you should toss it over the walls. And they said to him, but that's terrible. You'll be eaten by wild beasts, and your body will be mutilated. And he says, good point. So give me a stick, and I'll be able to beat these beasts and these others that would disturb me away. And they said, but you'll be dead, and you won't be able to do it. And he said, well, that's exactly the point. And you have to remember, this is in a culture in which burying the dead properly is of enormous cultural importance. I mean, Antigone, maybe the greatest of the Greek tragedies, is all about her insistence on burying her dead brother,
right?
In opposition to the state, which doesn't allow it. So it's a truly outrageous thing for him to have said, and it's one of these things which have echoed through the millennia, really, where everyone says, good point, but.
Yeah. Well, and the point is that a lot of people would agree that once the body has died, I mean, once you have physical death, it doesn't really matter. I mean, you know, they're sort of the soul or whatever has left, if there is such a thing as a soul. But we seem to attach enormous importance to what we do with those dead bodies. It is not just inanimate matter that we don't care about.
Right. That's absolutely right. It's not carrion. And the interesting thing is, people say they don't want to be buried like a dog, which means they don't want to be buried as if they didn't matter. But then, of course, dogs mimic humans, because many civilizations bury dogs like humans. So to be buried like a dog is to not be buried as a human, so to speak, to be left as carrion. And then to be buried is essentially to be incorporated in some version of humanity. And you're absolutely right. It's true whether we believe in a soul, whether we don't believe in a soul, or we believe in this kind of a soul or that kind of a soul. It's just true, which I found a kind of remarkable discovery.
Yeah. So why do we care so much about what happens to the corpse, to the dead body?
It's hard to answer that in a few seconds. That's what I spend, 300,000 words trying to unpack, and I'm not sure. I'm not sure. Have an answer, but I think the basic line is that the basic answer has to be some version that humans live with their dead, and we live with the dead in all sorts of different ways, but that's what we do. In other words, we in some sense enter into culture from nature through the incest taboo. That is to say, we don't breed like animals. We have some rules, whatever the rules are. So that's a kind of originary liminal moment when we leave nature and enter culture. And I think
to reiterate this, you're saying sort of that moment when we start burying the dead, when we care what happens to the dead, that's kind of when culture starts, when we're no longer just biological
creatures. Or burying
creatures.
Or burning. We don't know whether in Paleolithic times these people buried or burnt. Some of the remains we have, it's hard to tell. But probably burning, but we don't know. But you're right. I think that there's a sort of liminal moment, this kind of a moment when we leave nature and enter culture, is when we say the dead body isn't just nature. The dead body is part of culture, and it's part of our culture and part of our history. And as far as we can tell, humans or human-like creatures have been doing this for 50,000 years. I mean, our anthropologists and archaeologists keep pushing the date back.
Well, we know the Neanderthals buried
the
dead,
now know definitively,
tens of thousands of years ago.
We now know definitively. It had been an open question, and we know that at least some Neanderthals, that is, one Neanderthal site, has now been definitively shown to have been a burial and not just a body that happened to fall in a ditch. That's absolutely right. So it's this moment of, I take it to be a kind of moment of entry into culture that doesn't have anything to do with hygiene or with soul or with any of the other things. It's just a moment when we say, yes, it's matter, but it's our matter, and we as a species being, exist in time, and that this is what this body represents.
What makes you think that it doesn't have anything to do with the soul? Because the obvious explanation would be it's part of some religious ritual, and you are preparing this
right.
this dead person
well, that's
to,
a good
to,
question.
To go on and, to the next dimension.
That's a very good question. And you could argue that in some cultures, it clearly has to do with the soul. But on the other hand, we have all sorts of cases in which alternative views of the soul will lead to the same results, or believing in no soul leads to the same results. So St. Augustine made fun of the Greeks, especially of the of Virgil and the Aeneid, who writes about specters, ghosts that roam the earth because they hadn't been buried properly, as if it mattered where you were buried. And then Augustine goes on to say, well, we Christians obviously don't care about this sort of thing because it's just the body, and God can raise the body from anywhere. And he goes into long riffs about how the bodies of the martyrs are eaten by beasts, and the beasts are burnt, and the what's left is eaten by other beasts, and they're thrown in the river. In other words, God is able to raise the dead from anywhere. So that's the one story. On the other hand, Augustine and the church fathers of his generations created the idea of the cult of saints. And it's not just that holiness resides in the body of the saint. The dead body of the person who's next to the saint gains something from it.
And there was this whole mystique that went on for centuries, maybe still does, about what happens to the dead bodies of saints. I mean, they're revered, the dead bodies.
The dead bodies of saints are revered, but then so are the dead bodies of people who aren't saints. And the dead bodies of people who aren't saints are revered even in cultures which don't believe in saints. So American Revolutionary soldiers went by the church at Newburyport to touch the bones of the great evangelist George Whitefield, who was a Methodist and as anti-saint as you could possibly be. And to take another example, which I use in the introduction of my book, is the grave of Karl Marx. So here the Communist Party of Britain exhumed the body of Karl Marx in 1955 from where he was happily resting down the hill in Highgate Cemetery in London and moved him to the most prominent part of the cemetery and built a great monument to him. And enclosed under this monument his body, his wife's body, a child's body, the maid's body. And since then, since 1955, important communists from all over the world have been buried near there, some in quite magnificent tombs. Most recently, Eric Hobsbawm, the leading communist historian of the 20th century, has a tomb that's like an 18th century box tomb, except that he's cremated. And if you were to be an archaeologist and were to dig this up in 500 years, you would say, could this be a Sufi shrine? Maybe it's a Catholic shrine? And you'd make up some story. And these are all people, to a person, who believed that there was no soul, there was only material being, nothing survived death. And yet, the 100-year-old body of Karl, more than 100 years old now, body of Karl Marx, indistinguishable from all other bodies, is a place that people want to be buried next to. So then, if I may take it one further step, you might say, well, okay, it's just about memory, and the body doesn't make any difference. And I would say back to you, if the body weren't there, they wouldn't be putting other bodies there. And having the actual body in place, which costs them huge amounts of money, matters a great deal, despite the fact that there's no conceivable reason, intellectual reason, you could give for that for that importance.
Right.
So that's
so
what
you,
I want
you
to
don't,
say.
You don't want to just put a gravestone saying, you know, Karl Marx and the dates of his birth and death.
No, we
have to know that he was actually buried there.
We have to know that he's buried there. To visit an empty grave is to visit an empty grave. And that keeps coming up in, I mean, I cite in my book a bunch of cases in which someone wants to get the body of someone and say, well, look, we'll leave the tomb there. And they say, it doesn't count. An empty grave is an empty grave. You need a body.
Yeah.
And you need a body from the challenge. You need a body when we have the Challenger disaster. We need the body when a soldier dies in war and we don't get the body back. We need the body of poor people who we don't want to just have disappear. We need the body. And I think that's deeply puzzling.
We need the body because somehow this is part of how we commemorate that person?
It's part of how we commemorate. But even if we don't commemorate, it's part of what we take to be the notion of the continuity of humanity. In other words, it's hard for me to answer your question, not because you aren't posing it clearly and because there aren't many specific answers, but because there is no general answer. In other words, I'd like to be able to tell you we need the body because we believe we're commemorating the home, the former home of the soul. But what I the real reason is that we in all sorts of ways come to regard the body as representing the dead, of representing death, of representing the idea that humanity recognizes this huge condition of mortality as what and consciousness of mortality, which defines it. And therefore, what we do with bodies is so laden with the past. You know, that we, in the past, we used to, people dig up dead bodies to mutilate them. What a ridiculous thing to do. Except if some way digging up a dead body and mutilating is digging up and destroying a history, is digging up and destroying a set of relations which should be disrupted. It's of eliminating a people. And then recovering is a way of recovering them, of getting this back. So the Nazis burnt into ashes their victims, and these ashes are being collected and reburied in cemeteries all over Europe. So it becomes an act of annihilation, and it becomes an act of incorporation and into humanity and recovery. And so I call it the end of my introduction to this book something like a magic we can believe in, that in some sense we understand it to be strange, and yet it's hard to imagine being human and not, on the one hand, taking death very seriously, and secondly, taking the dead body seriously as being part of that huge complex that has dying, death, and the dead in a kind of triad.
Right. Now, if we focus on European history for a moment, there was this moment when the dead who had been buried for centuries in churchyards, kind of presided over by the local church, there was a shift to the cemetery. I mean, someone actually had to invent the idea of a cemetery that was no longer just associated with a church. Why was that such an important transition?
Well, it's an important transition because in some sense, it allowed people to recuperate something from classical antiquity which was valuable to them. That is to say, in classical Western antiquity, a family was responsible for taking care of the dead body. And anyone who could afford it could buy a place for a family and could care for this body and could return to this body. And so we know that in Roman antiquity, for example, manumitted slaves were particularly prominent in buying burial places as a way of expressing their social existence, or conversely, to get rid of the idea of social death, which is slavery. So what the church does in the 5th, 6th, 7th century is to make the church in charge of the dead and not the family. And the church decides who's in and who's out, and what sorts of people get places. And you're actually buried as a community. There are very few individual graves from the 6th or 7th century right up to the 18th and early 19th century. So then the cemetery becomes a place where all sorts of people can now make a claim on social recognition.
And you don't have to be religious to be buried in a cemetery.
You don't have to be religious. You can be religious of different sorts. So there are Jews that are buried near Christians, and Muslims that come to be buried near Christians, and national groups that come to be buried there, and you can be anti-religious. And so you become you produce a whole other kind of space. So instead of a churchyard, which is very much the yard of the church, you produce something which is a version of a garden, which you could fantasize as Elysia or as Arcadia or as a small provincial garden. You can make a fantasy, and you can put up anything you want, and you can be buried with your family or next to someone, and working class heroes can be buried in cemeteries, and bourgeois leaders can be buried in cemeteries, and swamis can be buried in cemeteries. And so it becomes a way of creating a new cosmopolitan community of the dead.
Maybe a more democratic form of burial.
Not to mention it's more democratic in this, but it's like lots of democracy. It's democratic depending on your means. That is to say, the cemetery is the first place where you could actually buy a freehold for burial since Roman antiquity. There was no one owned the church here but the community or the church. And in a cemetery, anyone can buy a place. So it can be mostly prosperous people, but can also be a collection of poor people who want to celebrate a working class hero, or secularists who want to celebrate a secular hero. anyone can buy a place. So it's more democratic, absolutely, but it's a democracy, like so much democracy, that depends on access to means.
Right. Now, if we're talking about this European tradition, so going from the burial in the churchyard to the mm-hmm. cemetery, when does cremation figure into this history?
Well, so cremation was one of the prominent ways of dealing with a dead body in Greek antiquity and in the Roman Republic. And for some reason, which no one understands, by the 2nd or 3rd century of this era, cremation stops. And so cremation is extremely rare. I mean, it exists amongst the Vikings. But as Christianization spreads in Europe and as the Vikings are Christianized and so forth, there basically is no more cremation.
Well, isn't the idea that the body will come back resurrected in Christian history?
Well, it's an interesting point because as the pro-cremation people kept pointing out, the church fathers kept talking about how our martyrs that are burnt whose bodies are destroyed will come back as well. But the story, what happens really is that in the French Revolution, the French revolutionaries bring cremation back as an explicit attack on the church. So they start cremating French revolutionary heroes in the style of Roman Republican heroes and having ceremonies about these ashes and putting these ashes in secular places as an aggressive anti-clerical act. So that sets up cremation as an anti-clerical act, even though there's no theological reason why that should be true. It's cultural theater, political theater. So when Napoleon makes his arrangement with the Pope, this so-called concordat, cremation becomes illegal in France again, and it was never illegal anywhere in Europe. And then in the 1860s, a group of Italian secular Freemason, anti-Catholic nationalists and their doctors start saying, the way forward, the way to get rid of all this superstition and all this is holding us back is to simply understand that when you die, the dead body is oxidized, and cremation is a faster way of oxidizing. And furthermore, we can do this better now that we have steel technology. So they incorporate steel technology in the cremation of bodies, and it becomes...
Wait, steel technology? What do you mean?
Steel making, as in making steel, which had a revolution in the late 1860s, which is basically the reverberating furnace, which lets it get very hot and lets either the steel, the ore, or the body, whichever you want, not touch the fuel. So they built these furnaces. The first cremations were all in ovens that they borrowed from steel, in some cases glass making technology, and they burnt these bodies in the late 1860s and 1870s, and it was this very aggressive political stand. And it's in face of that the church starts coming up with its opposition to cremation. The church had basically no views on cremation for most of its history, only occasionally when they were trying to Christianize the Vikings or someone, where they said, well, you can't cremate because that represented the old world. But the church had no view on this until the 1870s and 1880s, when they were opposing this technological, anti-cultural sort of hyper-modernism, if you want to call it that. So that's how cremation came in. And for its first 50 years, it really represented that. It was something that cool people did, doctors, artists, spiritualists, you know, weird people. After the Second World War, it became more commonplace.
Hmm. Oh, I would think there might also be practical reasons for cremation. I mean, you can run out of space in a cemetery or churchyard for burying actual bodies.
Right. You could, but again, the interesting thing to me is that, they argued that. But in point of fact, they had just produced so much space for cemeteries, and in Britain they just opened just in the 1850s the largest cemetery in England in Woking, which was about 4 square miles, and still hasn't filled up. So in other words, they made this practical argument, and in some places today, for example, in Singapore, that's an important argument for cremation. There's a big dispute about this there now. But in general, what's interesting to me about all this care of the body is that practical considerations are almost never the reason, though it's the first reason we come back to. We say hygiene is the reason, or smell is the reason, or space is the reason. And it's often given as a reason, so I'm not denying it. I'm just saying that when you actually look at it, it turns out there weren't that many space restraints and bodies aren't that dangerous and so forth. So there's a cultural drive which pushes this in absence of these other things. So eventually that does become important, as I say, in various parts of the world, China now also, as well as Singapore, where cremation is space-saving.
So if we bring this story up to the present, do you think we are as obsessed about dead bodies now as people were in previous centuries?
I would love to have a really good answer to that. I want to say I had a bumper sticker once that said, "Historians tell it like it was." I want to duck this question. I mean, I think, look, in certain instances, I think, and there are many of them, we care an awful lot about dead bodies. I mean, look how much news there was about Osama bin Laden's body.
Right. Or of course, that was dumped into the sea so that they're you know, to prevent people from making pilgrimages to where he was
buried.
But
we insisted that we had done it in a way that was ritually commensurate with Muslim practice, or the body of the Boston bomber, or the fact that all work stopped on Wall Street, and a great deal of money was spent building a park and an overpass around a slave cemetery, which was discovered when they were exploring for a large new building, and I could give you many more of those kind of examples. So clearly, we do care, and we're upset when an undertaker somewhere loses the ashes of paupers that it was keeping. So we clearly do care still, but I think if you ask me what the future brings, I think we've now we're now much more concerned with the question of dying is much more exigent, because dying in the last 15, 20 years has become so unmoored, so strange. It's become so difficult to die, in some sense because of the intervention of medicine, because our complicity with medicine and wanting to have control of something that's not controllable. So if I were writing this book in 100 years, I think I might be writing a book on the work of dying rather than the work of the dead. But it's very hard for me to see that. But I think if you were to ask me, yes, we still care about dead bodies. And people talk to me all the time about what they do with them. My grandmother's ashes, where I mix them with ink and I have a tattoo. My father's ashes, who's a photographer, we put in little vials and we spread it, film cartridges, and we spread it around the world where he had been. My father's ashes were sent into space. My mother's ashes were pressed into something. So everyone has a story. I don't think people don't care anymore.
So it sounds like, but it sounds like obviously your family cares, and I'm guessing you care.
Right. And the culture seems, we still care. We still need the bodies of soldiers back, and we still need as a culture to care for bodies. And we do, and I collect examples, and there are many of these examples of needing to have a body. You were asking me, dude, I think it's still as important, and I was saying, it may not be as important comparatively, because dying, which had been a relatively straightforward and simple process 100 years ago, or even 50 years ago, when there was relatively little to be done, and when one entered into this process, which was more or less understood, and we could be more or less complicit with it and accepting of it, has entered this world in which it's so connected to government and what's allowed in different versions of healthcare, with patient autonomy and the idea that someone wants to claim they can be autonomous to the very end or even after the very end. The ads for cremation would say, "Remain in charge."
Yeah.
And so, you know, dying becomes part of this huge, this I think gigantic story that you're obviously exploring, that takes you into sort of almost every realm of our existence. And so I think the dead body is still important, and it's probably as important as it was really. But I think that something new in this in our relationship to death, which in the West, which is to say dying. Now, in other parts of the world, I think the places of the dead are still hugely important.
Yeah.
And maybe as much as they always were. I think we in the West are in this next stage of dying in which we've essentially tried to make this a process which we can manipulate to the very end, which we both can and can't.
I want to come back to the story of your own family. And you were saying, you know,
yes,
some sort of elaborate measures have been taken to, you know, put ashes into various places. Do you have strong feelings about what should happen with your body after you die?
Well, I wouldn't say I have strong feelings. But I think I would like my daughter and my wife to think of my ashes as part of a continuity and spread some of them where my father's and my grandfather's ashes are spread in Hamburg. And I would like some of them spread near my wife's family's plot in a small hill town in the Santa Cruz Mountains where they had an apple orchard. So I'd like to think of myself as part of a kind of a continuity through what happens to my ashes. And as I write, I was surprised at myself that I cared so much about what happened to my father's ashes, despite the fact that I could give no rational reason for my concern and investment.
That's fascinating. So, I mean, obviously you do care about these things.
I do. But if you ask me why I care or to give you some account of it, I think I would start blithering. It would be embarrassing on the radio.
Now, one thing that I find interesting is there is a trend right now, probably still pretty small, of what's called green burials, which can take various forms. The most extreme version is you simply leave the dead human body out in nature and, you know, let the animals pick it apart, which I know the idea of that disgusts a lot of people. I mean, it goes back to sort of this ancient taboo that, you know, you're not supposed to do that.
You don't do
it.
Right.
And yet some people want to have this happen to them
after
they die.
That's absolutely right. And that also goes back to the Greeks. I mean, Heraclitus, a pre-Socratic, I mean, so generation 100 years before Diogenes, said that the best thing you could do with bodies is to have them fertilize the fields. So again, that's a very old story. And I think to me, what that says is that in some sense, how deeply people care about dead bodies. That is to say, they don't want to scratch the surface a little bit. It's a ritualistic thing to do with a dead body. They take it to a particular field. They don't leave it anywhere. They don't leave it on the golf course. What I've read about this, they leave it on farms with the person loved, or they leave it in places which the person who's mourning loved. And so it becomes in some sense part of a ritualistic practice and people's wish to live with the earth at peace, and the dead body becomes a way of doing that. So it's not tossing it over the walls. It's putting it in some place that you care about for a purpose that you care about, right? Diogenes said, who cares? The people who are doing what you're talking about care a lot. They care a lot. And they do it this way rather than putting it in an earth coffin or a cardboard coffin or cremating them and spreading the ashes. I mean, there are all sorts of ways you could return a body to nature.
Right.
And they choose that way. So what I would say in response to that is this is not Diogenes. This is another and new and inventive version. So what I really would conclude from all this is that the dead body was, in some sense, always enchanted or never enchanted. And it's still always enchanted or not enchanted. It's differently enchanted in different periods and at different times and in different places, including today.
Yeah. One final question. It seems like I have to ask you about zombies. The living dead.
I should know more about zombies. I'm sort of embarrassed.
why is our popular culture obsessed with zombies now?
That's really a good question. You know, I mean, again, the historian's cop-out would say, you know, this is not my period.
I don't know. I think zombies go way back.
They go way back. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Zombies do go way back. Well, I mean, I do think that zombies, you know, are sort of represent some version of the symbolic order of the world, to put it pompously, gone awry. I mean, there's something wrong with zombies and with how these dead were cared for. And it's just like dead bodies that aren't properly cared for come back as ghosts. And they've, as you say, zombies go back a very long way. They come back as fleshly ghosts, which is pretty close to a zombie. And I think these fleshly ghosts are versions of a world in which something was deeply wrong. And so I think that's why you get them in Haiti, for example. I mean, these places in which it's parts of Africa, places with this massive disruption, cultural disruption, and a history of cultural disruption. So, you know, I think zombies are the dead that are deeply out of place. And that's, I think, a sign of some kind of subcultural crisis. But why all these video games have zombies? And I wish I knew more about popular culture, but I wouldn't want to go on record on a subject I don't know very much about. But you're totally right. The zombies are everywhere, and they're very old, and they've come back in a big way.